For decades, we've dreamed of traveling beyond our galaxy. This fall, we will.
Neptune and back in 6 minutes.
A new era of discovery is about to begin.
Let's go.
Enterprise.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the first bridge ever.
Cam, let's just be honest. It's Tyler Orton rubbing decon gel all over his body and his ears. Yes, I gotta get on those ears.
Oh, you can do the ears yourself, is what you're saying.
Well, I don't understand, because there's a scene where Trip is applying decon gel onto his female colleague's ears, and she looks uncomfortable, and I'm like, oh yeah.
I was uncomfortable too, Tyler.
This is a year 2001. Yeah. It's a different era, and it should not have been a different era. But Cam, what is the conundrum this week?
We're going to talk about
decon gel.
Yeah, we're going to talk about all the ins and outs of decon gel. No, we're going to talk about Broken Bow, the pilot for Star Trek Enterprise. It's been a long journey getting from there to here, but we are now at Enterprise two-parters / extended episodes.
Yeah, so Cam, I think we want to tackle this almost from concept, because I remember at the time, this was the first, you know, internet era for me following the development of a series. And so right. It was cool to find out, you know,
Star Trek series, right?
Star Trek series, yes, that's true. But no, I was really big into Caroline in the City, you know, I was like, whoa, Leah Thompson's been cast or something.
Wow.
But with this, like, I was following who's being cast. I was following, like, even how the names of the characters changed. Like, it wasn't originally Jonathan Archer. It was originally Jackson Archer.
Yeah.
And also, like, Travis and Malcolm, their names are actually switched. Like, you know, so originally Malcolm Reed was the name of the helmsman, and Travis Meriwether was, and it was Meriwether at the time. It wasn't Mayweather. It was Travis Meriwether was the name of the armory officer. So it's like those kinds of fun developments that you get to like follow in the months leading up to it. I remember everybody went wild when like the design of the NX-01 was released, because people were like, wait a minute. That looks a lot like the Akira-class ship that appeared in Star Trek First Contact. Like, the BBS, you know, back in the day was just going wild with all of this stuff.
All the BBSs were. It was a different time.
Well, there's other crazy stuff, because we were getting, like, trailers for this, and when somebody saw Archer wearing that NX-01 cap, some guy on the Trek BBS started making his own NX-01 caps and selling them, and there were outraged people saying, you're defrauding Paramount, and it's just like all
and
this.
Paramount has never put out that hat.
No. Well, no, because we were just in Vegas at the big convention, Cam.
Yeah.
How much luck did I have finding like a good quality NX-01
hat? Not easy. I made my own for my cosplay costume.
It looks like it.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah. It definitely does not look professional. So. It's like the best I could do. I was like, well, can't really buy one. I am very curious, though, when you were tracking the development, was there casting decisions that excited you? Or did you spend most of it being like, who?
Well, that's just it. I never watched Quantum Leap.
Yeah.
And Scott Bakula was really the only name that was cast here.
You weren't a big fan of Major League Back to the Minors?
Only later in life.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So,
Necessary Roughness?
If that's what the name of it, I'll go with that.
Okay.
But I mean, like, honestly, I think the only name I may have recognized at the time was one Von Armstrong, who was just kind of known as the guy who's played more characters than anyone else on Star Trek at that point. So, no, so it was kind of an interesting process, you know, way back in the day. The other thing that a lot of people are talking about was, and we can get into this as we go on, though, but like the technological difference with, you know, doing this prequel series in, you know, the early 2000s, where obviously the design of the ship looks more advanced, maybe, depending on what you're thinking, than the 1701, both the exterior and the interior.
Right.
So there are a lot of debates going on, and I feel the same way with Discovery right now, another prequel series. And it's like, okay, I get it. You know, it has to be a visual reboot, because let's just be honest, are we really going to watch you know, the same sort of, you know, production design, which is beautiful in a nostalgic sort of way when you see it in an episode like Trials and Tribulations or In a Mirror Darkly.
Right.
Does it sustain itself for four seasons or so?
Right.
Kim, do you have any sorts of memories early on about this before you sat down and became a big Enterprise fan?
I actually do. I remember Entertainment Weekly really hyping Enterprise. And I think I talked about this in some episode we did long, long, long ago. But I remember they had like a shot. I think it was a decon gel shot. I really do. And it said like something like Star Trek is getting sexy or something. Like it was very much trying to sell the fact that whatever this Enterprise show was, it was not like any Star Trek show you'd seen before. It was a very intentional, you know, attempt to grab people who weren't Star Trek fans. Like this was something different. If you didn't watch Voyager, if you didn't watch DS9, it didn't matter. This was like a new thing. And I remember seeing ads for that. I remember they gave the Broken Bow pilot, I believe, a B- grade. And then that's the last I remember Entertainment Weekly ever mentioning that show again.
Did you have any interest at all in like this idea of a pre-Kirk era sort of Star Trek show?
No, yeah. I don't think it grabbed me at all. I don't really remember where I was in life at that point. Yeah. But so I would have been like 20, 21 years old. I think I was just like, I don't know, doing stuff. I didn't really want to schedule a show every week to watch.
Sure.
So yeah. If I were older, I would have watched it probably, given it a shot. But at that point, I was just like, another Star Trek show? I didn't even watch Voyager. What do I care?
Okay. Well, why don't we kind of tackle this in a different way? This is a series premiere, and I think it's a very different series premiere because, as you said, I think Star Trek was kind of trying to reinvent itself to a certain degree. And let's tackle it from kind of the very premise of like a prequel series where it's before the Federation officially forms. And I think what they wanted to do is get outside of that Gene Roddenberry box, as the writers often called it. Like, what if we go back to a time where, you know, humanity was a little bit more primitive? Does that open us up to kinds of new adventures? Now, we usually try to kind of tackle these ones in like a vacuum, like what it was like at the time. But you know what?
Sure.
We have all this perspective now.
Yeah.
What do you think of the idea, that the kind of initial concept of doing a prequel series in this particular era?
Well, I mean, it makes a lot of sense why they did it. This is arriving 2 years after The Phantom Menace, where prequels are obviously becoming big business in Hollywood. But I think it's interesting. I don't hate it. Like, I really do hate a lot of prequel ideas. But in this one, I actually think it's a good idea to show how we got to, you know, the original series. Because when you hop on board the Enterprise and the Man Trap, the first episode aired, everything, like the status quo is established. We're on the ship. This is how things are. I actually think it was really an interesting idea to kind of develop how we got there. Because it's not like a prequel where the storytelling feels awkward. You're not like trying to set up characters or relationships which feel weird, you know, trying to reverse engineer the evolution of that.
Yeah.
Explaining
except
how...
for the Klingons.
That was always great. But I mean, when you look at how did Starfleet go to space, that's interesting. Like, that's an actual organization, and how did they actually get to space? That's a mission-based idea that I think actually holds together. Like, you look at what the Star Wars prequels got wrong, a lot of it was, you know, who built C-3PO? Oh, it was Anakin. And everyone's like, wait, what? Whereas...
They're answering the questions no one asked.
Exactly. Whereas I feel like with Enterprise, they actually had a good idea of how did the humans and the Vulcans come together? What was the first trips into space like? I actually think it was a pretty good idea.
No, Charles Tucker.
The first Charles Tuckers to go to space. Yeah.
I'll say it for me. At the time, I didn't want to have a prequel series. I wanted Star Trek to move forward. But, you know, now that I have all this perspective, I appreciate so much what they're trying to do and kind of the opportunities they had with a prequel series. And I'll tell you why I have this appreciation now. I look at seasons 3 and 4 and you're like, oh, I think this is what they should have been doing for those first two seasons. And even Brannon Braga has come out and said, yeah, season 4 should have been season 1, essentially. And I think that makes a lot more sense for me now. And so I get to enjoy this Broken Bow pilot much more than I did at the time, the initial watch there. So for me, I dig this prequel series concept. And I was okay with it with Discovery as well. I thought that was kind of an intriguing way and way into the universe that we're familiar with.
I actually think Discovery stumbled a lot more at it than Enterprise did.
How so?
In terms of a lot of retconning in ways that felt, you know, not everyone loved them.
Like Klingons, for example.
Klingons, exactly. The introduction of the Michael Burnham character, like, I love that character, but it's, you know, there's a lot of grounds to be like, wait, what?
Like
why
her
did
connection
this character...
to,
yeah,
her connection to Spock.
Exactly, and the family will never speak of it again. Things like that. Whereas, and just the fact that Discovery existed as this state-of-the-art ship, whereas, like, Enterprise really didn't introduce a lot that... you know, maybe the more nitpicking fans could really, like, go nuts over.
I would say this, though, to counter that, though. You say Discovery stumbled more. I would say the first two seasons of Discovery are probably stronger than the first two seasons of Enterprise.
In terms of the actual, yeah, I wouldn't disagree with you there. In terms of the actual, like, entertainment value and the characters gelling very quickly. No, that is very true.
And maybe we never got, like, a fan service-y sort of episode like If Memory Serves, you know, the Discovery episode where we finally get back to Talos 4. Mm-hmm. Or is it Talos 5, Cam?
4.
4, okay. I got it right the first time. And we never got one of those episodes within the first two seasons of Enterprise, really, you know? Like, what's the most fan service-y stuff?
Is it the one where they go to Ryza in season 1?
Again, answering the question nobody asked. It's kind of like we're fans pining sure. for a return to Ryza. So
I don't know. They built it up over like 3 or 4 episodes where they're like, we're on our way to Ryza.
Yeah. Well, okay. So we kind of tackle like our initial thoughts about the whole premise of it. Why don't we kind of talk about Broken Bow itself, you know? Like there is some good fan service in this. And I don't know. Let's start about the characters here. One of my issues, and I'll just say this out of the gate, I think Broken Bow is a very strong series premiere. And yeah. But one of my issues is, like, they kept kind of say to the audiences, like, what if our characters act like jerks to each other the whole entire time? Like, and, like, that's one of the flaws of it, because it makes it harder to like everybody from the captain to the chief engineer to the... Vulcan science officer, the triumvirate of the series, because they're all being jerks to each other for, it seemed, kind of petty reasons at times.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is definitely, I think, a very intentional attempt to bring conflict into the crew again, because that's not something that was really around in Voyager. DS9 worked it in a lot more, but I kind of admire Enterprise when I'm watching this pilot in that it doesn't have the stateliness of the other Berman era shows. Like, I know a lot of people, and I think we both kind of said, like, early Enterprise, you're kind of like, well, these aren't, that's different from, say, Voyager stories. But in terms of how the characters behave, they feel a little rougher around the edges.
Sure.
I can kind of appreciate what they're going for, but yeah, like, a lot of it turns into just, like, bickering, and not the most, like, fun bickering.
Well, let's talk about intros of the characters. Our introduction to Adult Archer is essentially when we walk into that medical facility that's holding Klang, the Klingot.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I mean Klingon. And it's when he and T'Pol first meet. And you have a very volatile Archer. And when T'Pol calls him out for that, and he says, you don't know how close I am to knocking you on your ass. I'm like...
I know. I, like, sat up in my chair. I was like, whoa, I didn't remember that part.
Yeah. It's just like, okay. Yeah. So it's like you're setting up kind of the dynamic between the two. We also have this Saval very early on where he's known as Ambassador Pointy by a very young, you know, Jonathan Archer.
Yeah.
There's this antagonism against the Vulcans. And to me, it's almost like racism.
It is
uncomfortable to watch, especially knowing how Star Trek really is meant to be about inclusivity and diversity.
Yeah.
And I know we're supposed to have humans a little rougher around the edges. I'd like to think that inclusivity and diversity are something that still has acceptance, even in this rougher era, when we have a united Earth at this point. So you would expect that you can extend that to other species, too.
Yes, for sure. And I think it's interesting that, like, his father shows none of these traits.
Yeah.
And his father's apparently the guy whose, like, life's work was put on hold.
Yeah, his father seemed like a really good guy.
He seemed pretty awesome. Henry Archer, man, for the win.
Yeah.
Show should have been about him.
What did you think about maybe the introduction later of Trip when he's in that little shuttle pod? I think an ode to the motion picture worker bee scene.
Big time.
What did you think of the introduction with the dynamic between Archer and Trip?
Trip is a character that took a while to kind of warm up to me, like, watching the show. And, like, even rewatching this pilot, I'm like, yeah, he's kind of got that ah shucks kind of stuff. But I don't really, like, I don't watch that scene. I'm like, this character's popping. Like, this is a character I am going to be, like, really emotionally invested in by the time I get to, you know, seasons 3 and 4.
Isn't it hilarious, though, that he is essentially kind of the fan favorite from the series at this point? Like, he's the everyman that people kind of relate to and really love from the show.
Well, I mean, he's the character that grows the most throughout the series, probably. Him and T'Pol.
He definitely had, he definitely had, say, like, a lot more of that angst, that internal angst going through him as well. And I would definitely say... And were the seeds planted early on and, well, with the decon gel scene about kind of...
No, Tyler, they weren't at all.
But like with the dynamic between the two, where there is a certain amount of tension between the two.
Oh, you could tell they were setting up something.
Yeah.
I don't think they necessarily knew off the first episode if they were going to have a romance between those two or Archer and T'Pol. But I think they were just like, we want our options open, so set up these dynamics now because... we are going to probably travel down one of these roads in the future.
Okay.
And I mean, that decon gel scene is amazing for its close-ups and like weird, just a weird rubbing sequences of this. It's crazy long too. Like, it's really weird.
It makes me so, so uncomfortable to watch. Like, I can't tell you. I'm just like squirming as I watch this. I'm not a prude. I'm just like... yeah. What is the intention behind the creators, though? It's like, is this actually titillating? Do they think this is going to be titillating and get people to tune in?
Yeah, I do.
Do you think it's... is there an audience for this or like a broad audience for this, though?
Well, I don't have the stats in front of me. I would love to know what the top hour-long dramas were on TV at this point. Like, was there more of an interest in sort of, you know, a little bit racier TV? Like, was Sex and the City like a big show at this point?
2001, perhaps.
I just wonder if they were going, like, look, we're a network show, so we're not going to do that, so, you know, go that far, but we want to kind of introduce a little bit of a, you know, sexier kind of vibe to the show, because that's just what's kind of popular and out there right now.
I just think that more people found it off-putting than
anything
else.
Oh, for sure. I'm not saying it's executed well, but I think that was probably the intention.
Yeah.
I have to believe.
Okay.
Because otherwise they were just, like, losing their minds.
Well, let's talk about the intro of Hoshi as well, which I actually think it's a pretty bad intro where she has to make, like, these, like, noises. And it's just like, and she keeps having to repeat it for her student in Brazil, and it's
I would be that student who's completely unable to do that. I cannot do that to save my life.
The sequence wouldn't stop. They kept going back and forth like 5 times doing these silly noises, and I'm just like, okay, this is a great way to introduce one of your main characters.
I love that when you look at Memory Alpha, there's a lot of deleted scenes from this pilot.
Okay,
but they kept that extended section together.
My one problem, though, is, like, I find, like, Hoshi, a very endearing character.
Yeah.
I don't think they set up enough with her having kind of those space phobia issues, because what happens, though, is she essentially pops up later in uniform.
Yeah.
And she's just suddenly, like, kind of freaked out. I think they should have alluded to it a little bit earlier on or set it up, you know, dropped hints about it, about maybe why there are other reasons why she was a little reluctant to get on board the ship 3 weeks earlier.
I mean, the thing is, like, I do like the Hoshi direction in the fact she gets a pretty significant introduction. I mean, Archer has to go all the way to Brazil to get her.
Yeah.
Brazil/California. But I mean, like, that's not the case with any of the other characters.
Yeah.
They're right there. Like, this character is so important. They require a digression for Archer to go get them. So you're like, this is going to be an important character in this series.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the entire idea of this character who has to tackle alien languages for the first time ever for a human being, I actually think that's a really compelling story. I wish I'd gotten to see it. But it really does feel like this pilot is setting this character up for that journey.
Well, it just makes me... I was watching it and I was like, oh, this is a character who is super, super smart at what she does.
Yeah.
And that's one of my favorite things about, like, Star Trek is, like, getting to watch people be super competent at their jobs. And, like, it was kind of like, oh, I can admire this character.
And though, she has, like, really great, like, listening abilities you get to see exhibited on the show. Like, late in the episode, there's a part where, like, she can pick up Archer's, like, voice in, like, static. Because she's so good at hearing things. And I'm like, where was that the rest of the series?
I know. Then they give her stuff like finding out Malcolm's favorite cake. You know, like, it's just like, that's the unfortunate, like, journey of this character.
Or spending time with, like, the creepy psychic alien.
Yeah, I know. So, I think somebody who's very well served by a strong introduction, like, that really set out the character and what we could expect for years to come was Phlox, though. Because he's got kind of... A good line in that Klingon introduction scene in the medical facility where it's like, no, could die. could not, you know, maybe we'll see. And then we get to see him again, like carrying his like bats with dung into the new sick bay. And it's just like, and even that CG smile that he gets there, it's like, oh, this is kind of a cool, funky alien that we know can help even guide the crew.
He's definitely got a little bit of a mad scientist vibe. Yeah. It's an approach to a doctor we've never seen before. And I think that's what makes it really interesting, in that the other doctors feel like somewhat recognizable types of, you know, like a doctor you might meet in the real world. Whereas this guy, it's like, he's really unique and quirky and kind of odd, but also very compelling. Like John Billingsley brings a lot of just like gravitas to his lines. And so you're like, I mean, I really like this character, but he's very odd. And that's what I like about him, in that he does feel alien.
Yeah.
I do love the part where he's like, optimism, Captain. It's this really weird delivery. But like, there's a couple characters that feel a little off model in this one. Phlox feels just a touch off model. Like, he feels a little odder than he is in the episodes to come.
I agree. Yeah. But speaking of gravitas, or should I say gravity, I guess, you know, Mayweather's extended intro is in that gravity well scene there, where we get to kind of hear about his life as a space boomer, spending grades 5, 6, 7, getting to a planet. We hear a very strange story.
Oh, that was amazing.
About him fondling aliens. Like, I'm like, what is it? Is this a family show? Like,
again, I think something was in the water in 2001.
I think it's Rick Berman, like, typing away at the keyboard and then putting sunglasses on at the end. And just, like, thinking, like, oh,
cranking
yeah.
up Smooth Operator. I just kept thinking of the alien prostitute from Total Recall during the whole time I'm listening to that story. I'm like, is that some sort of in-joke related to Total Recall?
It was just, like, it made him sound more kind of like a dog. It made it Trip sound like a bit of a dog, too. And I was just like, okay. But I do like the concept of a space boomer, like somebody who's been like much further around the universe than anyone else. Because like Trip even said, I've only been to one other inhabited world other than Earth, and it's just a lot of dust.
Right.
I mean, Travis has gotten around quite a bit, though.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, okay. Now, that did not come out the way I intended. But the disappointment, though, is we know that we never go to that well, and for him to give much more advice or, you know, like, I think he had so much more knowledge to impart on the crew.
Yeah.
This is the most well-traveled person. Maybe T'Pol's done more, but remember the Vulcans aren't really explorers, though?
Yeah.
They kind of like doing their research, but they don't venture too far from their home planet.
Right. I know, it's, you know, you think of Neelix in the first three seasons of Voyager, where he's very much the guy who can chime in and be like, oh, I know of this species. They are this and this. Like, they could have really used Mayweather for that.
Yeah.
A lot more. Like, this is a guy who's traveled in these cargo ships for like many, many years. He's had a lot of encounters with aliens. He could actually have imparted some advice or wisdom or just, you know, knowledge to the crew. Where was that?
I wish it was throughout the series, you know. But
instead, we just get stories of him, like, fighting with his family over him leaving the cargo ships.
Yeah.
Which, you know, those episodes are okay. But, like,
are they?
They're okay. But, I mean, you think of what could have been done with this character, and the pilot definitely feels like Mayweather is going to be more of a character.
Yeah. I'd say the character who got probably the weakest intro was probably one Malcolm Reed, though. Yeah. I mean, he's defined more by his impersonation of Trip, going like, well, you know, you're going to have to wait.
Felt like a weird moment, didn't it?
Yeah.
Like, that is an off-model moment for Reed.
It really is. But maybe an on-model moment for the actor who played Reed was at Rigel 10, where he's staring at the strippers and just, like, gawking at them with, like a dog. And I was just like, okay. And then he's like, are those butterflies real? When, like, because the strippers are essentially, like, extending their tongues to eat butterflies.
Yes.
It was a weird moment. I was like, it was another one of those things that kind of took me out of it.
Again, what was going on in 2001? Like, they are very much throwing a lot of quote-unquote sexiness into this pilot.
I think that's what their mandate was. They wanted to look, one of the things that we've always talked about, though, is how prudish Star Trek is when it comes to sex.
Sure.
And it's like they seem to not be able to address it very often in a very adult manner. And I think part of it is, we'll be honest, like, United States family television is conservative. You know, right. And I say that small c conservative thing there, even though, you know, Gene Roddenberry, very progressive, you know, person. So maybe as Canadians or maybe some of our European listeners can kind of say like, oh, yeah, it is kind of prudish. But I think they're trying to make it sexy and they're going hard at it. And I just
they were.
it took me out of it lot of the times, though. Like, I don't know if the execution was very well done, because let's be honest, the people behind it, Brandon Braga, Rick Berman, they weren't used to executing this sort of stuff.
Definitely not, no.
So, you know, and I'll say this, I don't think they got any better at it as the series progressed either.
Although it doesn't feel like there's that much of it as the series goes. I can definitely think of some episodes.
There's more decon gel. And
sure.
Thinking about an episode like Bound, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the ones that pops to mind. Or also the Ryza episode. Yeah. There's a couple in there. But it doesn't feel like the show goes to that kind of well, like every, you know, second episode or anything. Which, you know, this pilot really does give you the impression like, wow, this is going to be a very different journey.
Yeah. So, okay, so we've covered the main characters. Let's talk about kind of the premise of the pilot episode. We've talked about the premise of the series. We like it. I think this is a swashbuckling adventure. This is how you want to set things up. I mean, it starts on planet Earth. You go to Rigel 10. You go to this really cool concept of a space station. It's all built from other spaceships. And then you finally end up on Kronos. You know, you really do feel like you've gone on this big adventure with this crew all in like 90 minutes. I think this is like the way you start a Star Trek series where you're seeking out new life and civilizations. I think this is great.
I have a question, though.
Yes, sir.
With this one, like, because I'm of two minds of Broken Bow as a pilot. I think as a Star Trek series pilot, I think it's really entertaining. I really do enjoy watching it. If I were a new viewer, I would find this episode bewildering.
Like, do you think that there's too much backstory, too much history going on here?
Too much mythology being introduced right off the bat with all the Sulaban stuff that it's all being left as breadcrumbs for the future of the series, which, as we all know, is going to be pretty rocky in terms of tackling that mythology in the temporal Cold War. But, like, it does feel like it's a lot to hang on this, especially without, like, a really concrete conclusion where the new viewer who's never watched Star Trek and is being marketed a show called Enterprise, not Star Trek Enterprise, Enterprise, as in like this is an entry point for you who maybe didn't watch other Star Trek shows. To me, I think a lot of this would be really off-putting.
Do you think it's just because it's kind of sci-fi?
It's very sci-fi, but it also feels very complicated. And it doesn't feel like it resolves itself in a way that a new viewer would be like, oh, cool.
Well, let's talk about that conceit, though, with them introducing the temporal Cold War.
Yeah.
I was actually intrigued by it when I first watched it, but sure. I was like a Star Trek fan. But the thing is, as this temporal Cold War progressed, you know, we should be analyzing Broken Bow in a vacuum, but let's be honest, we can't.
Yeah. And we are going to talk about Shockwave later down the road. But yeah.
But it got more frustrating to me. And I can see your point in that, like, maybe some new viewers that weren't familiar with Star Trek tuning in and me like, wait, is there stuff that I'm missing out here?
Like, it really does feel like it.
Yeah. Like, should I know about this sort of temporal Cold War? Like, I've heard of Klingons before, but should I know who the Sulaban are too?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like there are some things that's, it's tough because the other thing is like the temporal Cold War was mandated by the studio. It wasn't something that Brandon Braga and Rick Berman wanted to pursue initially. So they had to kind of wedge it in there somehow.
Right.
I think you could have had this Klingon story, you know, done differently. Oh, I'll say this though. Did you not kind of pick up some, or maybe Discovery picked up some sort of threads, but like what the Sulaban were doing, were trying to incite the various houses against each
other.
That
popped into my head as well when I was watching it today.
Yeah, it's like, okay, it kind of reminds me of what we saw in Discovery. So I think it is interesting. I think the concept of a temporal Cold War is interesting, but time travel gets really sticky.
It does.
And if you have your entire mythology kind of centered on that, I don't know, you better have a good game plan.
Yeah, and I just wonder to a lot of, you know, newbie viewers, when you have this, you know, shadowy figure from the future, and none of that, of course, is resolved as to who this character is, it never is, period, and this Silic character who's not really established yet, he's important in this episode, but he's not an established character yet, I just wonder if to a new viewer, you should have established maybe the players a little more, just so that they get a sense of, like, who are these people and why am I coming back?
There's so much, like, plate spinning and juggling going on, though, because you have to serve so many masters,
totally.
Especially, like, with a pilot series, a prequel series, you know, so I'll give him a pass on this one. Like, I think this is a solid series premiere. I think it's maybe the best one after Star Trek Voyager's Caretaker. I think yeah. Star Trek, I think Caretaker is still the strongest one from the outset.
Yeah.
But I just think this is like a solid adventure here. I don't know. Something that jumped out to me is like when I was on Rigel 10,
mm-hmm.
even just that shot of them landing at that snowy platform.
Yeah.
And
it definitely feels like they've. I'm not, like, I know this was a $12 million pilot, so some, you know, some money was involved in this one, but it does feel just like the visuals of Star Trek are being changed here
yes.
for Enterprise. Like, we've criticized in the past, as I said, like, you know, the Enterprise didn't feel that different from Voyager, but when you rewatch this pilot, it does, actually. Like, it does feel like they're taking a more modern aesthetic, and by when I say modern, I mean very 2001. It has a lot of that kind of bluish gray kind of, you know, that like kind of Bourne era. Or, this is pre-Bourne, but like the Matrix
sort of aesthetic. They're using like night vision to depict the yeah. Sulaban running around the ship, you know, when they had yeah. cut the power to the ship. You know, I was like, I've never seen night vision used in Star Trek before. Like, it's actually kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. There's also that shot when they were escaping from that one area of the spaceport. And there's that elevator lift just like zooming up. And I've never seen a shot like that done in Star Trek before either. And I was yeah. just like, okay, they want to kind of stretch, you know, or spread their wings just a little bit. And I can appreciate what they're doing. And also that Rigel 10 sequence, I felt like I was on kind of an alien outpost. Like it felt right. like that to me. And I think it was a very effective thing that they accomplished there. And I was like, this is a good solid sequence. I'll be honest, I kind of get bored during phaser fights.
Yeah.
So this wasn't the most exciting phaser fight I saw, and no. it went on for quite some time,
it
though.
It did, yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah. Enterprise never did phaser fights well. I don't know that there's a single good one in the entire series.
If there is one, write in. We can't think of it yeah. at this moment.
Here. Yeah, but I do like that, you know, the original series was very much like, had that kind of Wild West kind of attitude to the show. This does feel like it's trying to touch more into that. Like, it's trying to bring kind of that roughness, that sense of the frontier we haven't explored, and much more of that action sort of feel to it. Whereas when you get to, like, the 24th century, it's much more contemplative. It's much more based on philosophy than when you have the older Trek. And I think Enterprise is a really good, you know, this pilot is a really good attempt at bringing in sci-fi ideas, but also keeping that action kind of quotient amped up so that it does feel like a more energetic series.
Do you think it was effective at maybe being a more modern version of Star Trek? You know, like,
for 2001, yeah.
Yeah, it still has the Berman feel
mm-hmm.
to it, though, but I think it definitely feels, I guess, looser than, say, Star Trek Voyager.
Yeah, it does. Know? It does. It feels like there's, like, you know, some handheld camera in there, even in spots. Like, it feels like it has that kind of jittery energy to it, which you would never see really on Voyager.
Yeah.
Like, that's just not the way they shot the show.
If we fast forward a little bit, we do have that sequence when they go to that gas giant and they encounter the Sulaban space station / hive of little ships.
Oh, the Helix?
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting concept. I thought that was well executed as well, just from both the ship-to-ship combat stuff, even using like a grappler hook, you know, that was introduced here.
That is my favorite moment, when they use the grappler to grab the little ship
yeah.
and the guy goes ejecting out. All you need is like a sound on the soundtrack, and I would be like, that would be the greatest moment in Star Trek. I burst out laughing so hard watching that guy just like leap out of the ship.
He was very clearly a CG individual.
He was?
That. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they didn't go to a real gas giant and film that on location, I'm afraid. Man, if only. But I thought it was a cool concept, and I did like that time chamber sequence. You know, like, you and I, we can kind of nitpick a little bit about the whole temporal Cold War, but I think it was an effective, it was a memorable thing, and I think
they were so proud of that sequence.
Well,
when Archer walks in, and then we spend like maybe 30 seconds of him waving his hands around, looking at them, it's like you could tell that they were like, this is so cool, and we are going to show off how cool it is.
But you know, the fact of the matter is, like, it's actually very memorable, and
it
I'm
is.
Like, okay. And there is one very cheesy line where, like, the Sulaban, what is the actor, Silek? Silek says
yeah,
to...
John Fleek plays him, yeah.
John Fleck, yeah.
Oh, Fleck, yeah.
You know, but the character is Silek, and he says to Archer, I know the day you're going to die. I guess I'm wrong. And then he shoots him, and then, like, Archer dodges.
It's not only cheesy for the line, it's cheesy for the slow motion phaser beam, and Archer being like, whoa, 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 and jumping out of the way.
As you say, it's very Matrix-esque.
Oh, yeah. So. It would be amazing if he'd done the full, like, Trinity tilt back and wave. Or no, it was the Neo that did that. The, like, fall backwards and do, like, the waving the arms. Well, that would have been incredible.
Remember that episode of Voyager where I think is, like, the Doctor, he took, I think, the form of B'Elanna? And he did, like, a Matrix-esque walk up the wall, and
This is not ringing a bell.
This is, like, season six, I think.
Okay.
I can't remember. It was a Doctor-centric episode. I know it sounds bizarre, but I swear, like, everybody is talking about, like, how they're kind of jumping onto the Matrix bandwagon in
Everyone
that day.
Was, to be fair.
Oh, yeah. Even I remember... the TV movie Merlin jumped on to the bullet time cam too.
Right. Oh, that was a huge thing for about a year.
Yeah. Let's tackle this because we've been told for a long, long time that the first encounter with the Klingons was an utter disaster.
Right.
John goes out of his way to make sure that Klang is on his feet and not in, like, a comatose state to be presented to the Empire. Otherwise, he'd face great, great dishonor.
Right.
And, you know, obviously, he's carrying kind of these plans within his DNA. I think it's actually kind of an interesting revelation there. Was this a disaster, though?
No.
No, it wasn't. No.
I mean, it's a little bit of a disaster just in terms of all the... you know, the hoops they have to jump through just to get this Klingon. But, I mean, I don't know that the Klingons would consider that a disaster, and I don't really understand where that came from.
Yeah, so, I mean, maybe Picard was incorrect when he made that assertion. You know, I think he did that in First Contact, not the movie, but the episode.
Right.
And I'm kind of, I don't know, I had expectations for something disastrous to unfold, and we didn't get that, but... It's kind of hard because, like, what are you supposed to do? End the episode with your hero failing? It's not how you necessarily do a series premiere.
Well, I mean, in a different world, I wonder if they would have maybe been smart to build the, you know, the first season arc around the Klingons, kind of like Discovery did, because that would be much more friendly towards non-fans who are aware of what a Vulcan and a Klingon are.
Yeah.
And in which case you could have done about how, you know, their first encounter didn't go well and why it's important to establish the protocol for meeting new species. Like, I'm not saying I, you know, would dismiss the Broken Bow pilot, which I really enjoy. I just think that maybe if you're pitching to a new viewer and you're trying to draw in new people, you want to tell that kind of Klingon story.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the mythology of Star Trek as well while we're on the Klingons, because I think a lot of us at the time that this is in development, we're wondering, well, what are the Klingons going to look like at this point?
Yeah.
This is a prequel series.
Yeah.
So this is where you start to introduce a lot of the trickiness about, I think we counted it in our Klingon episode. Haven't the Klingons had like 13 different looks and designs over the years? Like
they've had quite a few, yeah.
Very many iterations of this very iconic species, which is fascinating. I can't wait to see them redesigned yet again.
But yeah, check out our Evolution of the Klingons episode for more on that. I'll post a link in the show notes.
Yeah, and for this, though, like I was a little bummed that we didn't get to have kind of those old school Klingons, you know, that we knew from the Kirk area. I think we could have kind of gotten away with that, and it still would have, we could buy them as Klingons, maybe put like tiny little ridges on their heads or something
kinda
like that.
Kind of go in between.
In between,
you
know, yeah.
You don't have to go original series where it's just like grease paint. You can do a little bit of an in-between, you know, a little bit of a visual reboot just to establish that they do look different.
But my issue, though, is like, oh, these are not the Klingons from the Kirk era.
Yeah.
These are essentially the Klingons from the Picard era.
Yeah.
And, like, that's where I'm like, I have trouble wrapping my head around everything. And
there
I guess
to be a conversation, right?
There must have been, but I think it was a pretty short, I bet it was a pretty short conversation, though. And they're like, no, let's go with what's familiar to audiences. We don't want to confuse them. And okay.
We don't want to confuse them.
Well, I know. So let's insert a temporal Cold War instead. So, but but you know, it's shorthand, though.
Yes.
And so I can buy that.
I mean, the Klingons with the ridges have been iconic at this point for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
So, like, I can totally understand why they're like, you know what, let's just not even do that. Like, it's just too much of a headache to try to explain.
Yeah. Headache. Yes. But speaking of iconic aliens, let's talk about the Vulcans. That introduction in that medical facility where we're getting the patronizing version of the Vulcans, and we even have Saval raise his voice to Archer. And
Archer like calls him out. Did you notice that line looks really ADR'd?
No, I didn't.
Like, I am pretty sure that that line was not there initially.
Archer's call out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it comes across as like ADR.
Well, it's like, I found it off-putting, though, because these are not the Vulcans that I'm most familiar with, though.
Right.
I do appreciate that by season four, they kind of explain all of that.
Yeah.
I honestly think that if you're going to retcon stuff, season four, it had some... a little bit of trial and error. I think they succeeded well with the Vulcans explaining why they've changed. The Klingon stuff, though, was very, very hokey, and
right.
I didn't necessarily appreciate that. But from the outset, I wasn't feeling the Vulcan depiction here, especially with, I guess, how T'Pol is depicted as well, where she's very antagonistic towards the crew.
Yeah.
She's also kind of verges on the racism thing, where she's almost racist against humans.
Sure.
Talking about how smelly they are. And
I would argue she is, and they are against her as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're really douchey when, like she's a vegetarian, and they're having the dinner, and they're just like, we're going to have giant steaks and make jokes about you eating, like, spare ribs.
And they're just like... like chomping down, like
She's like pulling like a Seinfeld Mr. Pitt, like cutting a breadstick with like a fork and knife.
I actually thought that sequence, I initially thought it was kind of stupid, but then at the very end where she perfectly cuts the breadstick and then holds it in front of them, I was just like, oh, that's kind of badass.
Like, for a character moment, it's actually pretty good. But it seems like, again, really antagonistic for someone who's coming on your ship. And if you dislike her this much, why have this private dinner?
Well, for show, you know. But
I guess
I know.
But it seems like when it's two against one, it gets a little weird.
Yeah,
and that's the case here, where it's like Tripp and Archer versus her.
Let's also talk about the Suliman, though. They're kind of being introduced here as the new big bad for the series. It's like we've already had, you know, Klingons and Vulcans. You know, like, are we really going to spend that much time? I guess if we have a Vulcan, you know, main cast member, we will. But I think they wanted to change things up, and I think the introduction of a temporal Cold War actually gives the writers a legit opportunity to introduce a new alien into a prequel series. And I think the concept behind them, in which they've been receiving like genetic enhancements in exchange for, I guess, like this black ops work or whatever they're doing, it still frustrates me that people on Star Trek don't seem to understand what the concept of evolution actually is. They like, everybody seems to think it's like predetermined traits that just need to be unlocked within a species. And it's like, that is not how evolution works, or even the concept behind it. Don't know how that's gotten into public consciousness, but okay, Star Trek, you should be teaching people what evolution really is.
Let's remember, this is from the this episode is from the author of Threshold.
Okay, yeah, that's true.
I'm willing to go down this road with the evolution.
Yeah, but what did you think about kind of the beyond, you know, a lot of, you know, dropping mythology onto new viewers? Yeah. What did you think of the concept of the Suliman?
Visually, I think they're incredible.
Yeah,
and I think they do. I think they do a pretty good job with them. I wouldn't give it an A, but I would go like maybe a B, B minus, because I think they do a lot in terms of establishing the visuals of the Suliban, introducing like the, because there's that great scene where like Phlox is doing the autopsy and pointing out what they have genetically that makes them stand out, what makes them fearsome. You get some really great shots, or CG-wise not great, but just cool shots of like their bending limbs, or, you know, climbing under the door of that grain silo.
Or they can go chameleon style.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah, climbing on the ceilings of the Enterprise. Like, in terms of their physicality, I think they do a really good job establishing what makes them scary or what makes them fearsome. But I don't know that necessarily the show does a great job in selling what makes them and their kind of mythology special. Like, when I think of the Borg, for example, which are introduced, you know, in the second season of Next Gen, you understand in that one episode everything you need to kind of know about the Borg and what makes their gimmick cool.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't know that the Suliban, that comes across right away.
Well, the problem is, like, the only compelling Suliban character you meet is Saren, the female, and then she's killed off.
Yeah, why would they cast Melinda Clark in that role and then kill her in, like, two scenes?
Well, you know, it's a series premiere. Like, they'll get a big name if they can for a character that's going to die anyways. It's right there in the script. But the problem is, they don't make Silic compelling, I think, until Stormfront, and that's right. a pretty horrible episode. But this is the first time he's actually been kind of an interesting, nuanced character.
Yeah.
That took, you know, four seasons for him to get to that point, though. And I think that's what eventually went wrong with the Suliban. Great concept, cool execution, but just no characters that we ever cared about, even as like a villain we'd love to hate, much like Gul Dukat was.
But even like Species 8472, when they show up, I feel like they sell the concept very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't know that they do with the Suliban. Like, the Suliban feel a little more convoluted. And that, like, as people who have watched the first couple seasons of, you know, the entirety of Enterprise, we have much more of a grasp on them. But I do wonder, like, if you are just watching this pilot, you know, does, like, this alien species, do you have a good grasp on who they are when this pilot ends?
I thought I did, though.
Did you? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, they worked for me at the time, and I was intrigued by them, to say the least. And
I think they're intriguing. I mean, the visual goes a long way.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. But do you mean, like, who they are as in, like, who they are personality-wise, kind
yeah.
of? Like, how are they distinct from other aliens in their emotional core, more so than their physicality?
But also, we don't really know what they want, because it's so tied with the temporal Cold War that is vague. And so it's kind of like, okay.
Well, that's a fundamental problem if you don't know what your characters, especially your antagonist, even wants. Like, that's just like writing 101. And I think, and the things like writers still often stumble with that issue.
Yeah.
So it's kind of surprising here. But I'll give them a pass, the writers a pass, because this whole Temple Cold War was, again, wedged in.
Yes.
Like, so, you know, what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe some fan service-y stuff I wouldn't mind mentioning. Did you notice the name of the farmer that shot the Klingon? In the chest.
Yeah, it was named after Ronald Moore, right? It's like Farmer Moore or
yeah.
something like
so
that.
So I like how the father of Klingon culture took a shotgun and blasted away like the first Klingon that humanity ever encountered.
Yeah.
I also appreciate how, I guess, gun control's never taken a hold in U.S. of A, even by, 2260-something.
Yeah, that would seem to be the case.
Yeah.
You know, isn't that the ultimate, like, cliche, though, of, like, the farmer with the shotgun?
Yeah.
It's just, like, the phaser version of that?
I would just assume that... you don't need guns, but I said 2260 something. I think this was actually 2155.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure you don't need guns on Earth in this era.
Right.
You know, it's just kind of like, okay, I know they're going for the whole like farmer with a gun trope, but whatever. You know. Also, the name of the admirals, though. Admiral Forrest, obviously a shout out to DeForest Kelly. I think there was a commander, what was it, a Commander Leonard?
Yeah.
And an Admiral Williams as well. So it's like you got kind of that triumvirate, you know, William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. So.
Had you ever realized that Admiral Forrest was named after DeForest Kelly? Like, that had never occurred to me.
I did, because at the time when the series premiered, or they were doing like kind of rundowns of the characters, like somebody online had pointed it out. So that was something I was aware of, yeah.
Apparently there's a character in this called Toss, too, which was the original series. The acronym, yeah.
Was that like a Vulcan, like in the background?
Like a credit character that's never named in the episode.
Sure.
But they were definitely throwing in some Easter eggs there. What did you think of the phaser pistol?
The phase pistol?
Yeah.
Yeah, the phase pistol, only has two settings, Cam. Stun and kill. Best not get them confused.
That's right.
That's actually an okay line from Reed there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's like, yeah, of course we kind of expect this at this time. It's, you know, do you have something to say of intrigue with regards to the phase pistol?
Not really, but it does feel very like 2001. It does feel like, you know, the fact that they look a little more like guns is just after the Matrix, as we've said. Like, the idea that they don't look like your standard original series phasers. I mean, those ones, they did have the gun ones as well, but they looked more like ray guns, whereas these ones definitely have more of that kind of... You know, like, they look more gun-like.
Yeah, that's true.
Than, like, ray pistols.
Yeah. Why don't we talk about the whole, everybody wants to hear about this, theme music choice here. Like, this is one of those controversies that just doesn't die. I will say this, so I was watching, like, some sort of, like, Blu-ray extras. I forget for which series, but Dennis McCarthy and I think it was Ron Jones, they were talking about how they were both deployed to come up with a theme music for Enterprise. And I think what we ended up, if you go to the end credits of the show, the music that plays over that, That was Dennis McCarthy's version of what was originally supposed to be the theme song for the series.
Right.
It's a perfectly nice theme song, and we actually get allusions to it in the space dock departure sequence. Like, it's actually kind of playing through. Like, I thought it was a great musical moment there. But, I mean, this series got so much crap over... The name of the song is actually Where My Heart Will Take Me.
I know. Everyone calls it Faith of the Heart.
Yeah. But, I mean, I hated the song at the time. I've kind of grown to, like, appreciate it from a pure cheese perspective.
Yeah.
I think the title sequence is fantastic. I think it's the best title sequence we've ever had in Star Trek.
It's up there. The TNG one is pretty amazing, too.
Well, it's mostly
it's simple, but it's
the ship zooming through space.
But it's cool. When the saucer comes up through the bottom of the screen, it's incredible. That's like fist pumping.
I cannot deny that. I cannot deny that. But what's your take on the opening sequence and the theme music, Cam?
The opening sequence is amazing. Like, the evolution of exploration is a great concept. I wish that Star Trek Discovery had tackled something with a little more of a concept than what they came up with, which is like collage. But I love all the visuals of the introduction to Enterprise. The song, I think it's terrible. I mean, what do you say about this song? I mean, it just feels so square and so just cheeseball, and it has not aged well. It's something that when I often skip through it. Like, I don't generally skip through the introductions of Star Trek shows. I will sit and watch the TNG opening or the original series opening every time I watch an episode. But boy, that Enterprise one, it's often a mood killer. Like, you'll have this teaser for the episode up front, which really, you know, sets a really cool tone for what you're about to go into, and then it just cuts to those twanging guitar strings, and I'm like, this does not match at all.
It's bad dad rock. Like, there's a lot of good dad rock out there.
Yeah.
This is like, oh, my dad picks up his music at Starbucks. That's where he finds new music.
Yeah.
Like, this is just like... Rick Berman must have felt just horrible that everybody now knows he has bad taste in music, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, as they've said, they originally wanted Beautiful Day by U2, but that's also, like, kind of dad rock, you know?
It's a better song, though.
It is a better song, but it's not from the more experimental era of U2.
It's also, you wouldn't point to that era of U2, point to that song and say, oh, that is hip. That is what the kids are listening to
definitely
nowadays.
Definitely not, no.
Yeah. What would the kids have been listening to? 2001.
New metal is pretty much fallen off. I think we've got the rise of pop punk at that point.
Well, let's hope. So, like, emo sort of stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think, like, well...
No. You know what? It'd be like, say, White Stripes and Strokes were, like, coming on pretty big. So, you know, maybe...
The Vines?
The Vines?
Yeah.
Sure. The Hives, you know, that could have been one as well. So it would have been kind of the that New York scene, you know, sort of deal, like post-punk sort of stuff that we could have gotten instead. So
that or Avril Lavigne. Yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Which one's the skater boy of the crew?
Is Hoshi Avril?
Sure.
Okay. So who's the skater boy? I think it has to be Phlox.
Is Phlox the skater boy? That makes about as much sense as anything.
Because she said, see you later, boy.
That's true enough.
That's about as much of the lyrics as I can recall from, you know, almost 20 years ago.
Now, I am curious, though, with the opening theme of this show, what do you think of the version that we get for the first two seasons, where we see here, obviously, showcased for the first time, which is more of the... This, I mean, it really reminds me a lot of, like, the Diane Warren, like, compositions for, like, Armageddon, where it's that, like, you know, that Aerosmith song.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it definitely reminds me of that.
I think the Aerosmith song is better, though. Like,
I don't like it, but I think I'd agree with you.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I think they're both bad.
Yeah.
You know, like, I think I prefer the new version just because it's a little bit more up-tempo.
Right.
But I don't know, like...
It's kind of like...
Cam, this is like we're kind of splitting hairs here. It's kind of like, you know, they both suck.
Yeah, yeah. It was a really bad note to start your pilot off on.
But the thing is, like, if the whole idea is, like, this ain't your daddy's Star Trek,
right,
and you're most known for having, like, the cheesiest, lamest dad rock song,
yeah,
like, where are you at right now, guys?
Was it ever a good idea to use a popular song?
No.
Yeah, I think they should have just gone orchestral.
You know, I mean... the one other thing that you could have done, though, And I can't believe we didn't think about this before, but, J.J. finally gets it into canon with Beastie Boys' Sabotage, you know?
Right.
I would have loved it if... Hey, look, if the introduction was all of the characters, but it was themed like the Sabotage music video.
Right.
It was just like Jonathan Archer with like a big mustache on and like Hoshi whipping off sunglasses and like Reed like banging his hand on the interrogation table, you know, like that would have been the most amazing opening sequence like in Star Trek history.
Were we in the era yet of TV where they'd gotten rid of opening credits?
No, not quite.
Not quite? Yeah. I wonder if it would have been interesting to have more of a logo flash with maybe like a 15-second fanfare or something, 10-second fanfare, and then have your credits played, you know, over just the cast.
I'd have been down for that. It would have been more modern, you know.
Yeah.
What did you think about the idea of taking Star Trek out of the title?
I can understand why they wanted to do it, I guess, because it, when you call it Star Trek Enterprise, it feels like the fifth series or whatever. Yeah. Like, it does feel like another chapter in a series that if you haven't been paying attention, why would you continue now?
I mean, it didn't irk me. I know it irked other Star Trek fans. It never irked me because, as you say, I totally understand why they're doing that. And
yeah.
But the thing is, like, isn't it a fundamentally flawed sort of concept? Because their whole idea is like, well, let's take Star Trek out because maybe that's not super hip or cool. But they also know, well, Enterprise is so iconic. Everyone associates it with Star Trek anyways. That's why we can get away with the marketing. But I'm like, well, if everybody automatically associates, you know, Enterprise with Star Trek.
Yeah.
Well, then what's the point of taking Star Trek out?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit like Smallville in a way. Just calling it like Smallville or Gotham, you know, shows like that where it's very recognizable.
That totally makes sense, though.
Yeah, I get it. Like, and if you're selling it as a prequel, it's kind of like, this is Enterprise. You don't need to have seen the other shows. I get why they did it. I don't think we'll ever see a Star Trek show in the near future that doesn't have the Star Trek name in it.
I was thinking that the only one that we would ever have a chance would be Star Trek Picard. I honestly thought they were going to call it Picard.
Yeah.
Tyler's dead wrong about that. It is Star Trek Picard, so.
Yeah, we saw, there was a movie trailer we saw recently that had a really convoluted title, and it's not the Fast and Furious Presents. There was another one that was like, had the franchise name really awkwardly wedged in.
Yeah.
And it's just like, boy. Like, they just, nowadays, they are just terrified of not having that, you know, brand name in their title.
Yeah.
And, you know, so maybe it'll be another 20 years or 15 years before we get a Star Trek show that tries it again. And, I mean, even Enterprise didn't stick with it. So,
yeah, you know. Exactly.
I want to, circle back to the Vulcan stuff with T'Pol briefly, just because one of my issues with this pilot is, like, T'Pol is very antagonistic. That's fine. You know, they established that the relations between humans and Vulcans isn't great. I think one of the big issues, though, for me with this story is that later in the story, there's this argument between T'Pol and Trip, where it's about, you know, Archer has told Trip to come back for him, to pick him up and to bring him to safety. And then T'Pol's now saying, no, that's not what, you know, I have to interpret the captain's orders. And I think from the point of view of the viewer, T'Pol is in the wrong. And I think that's a big problem. I think it would be far more interesting and far more Star Trek-y if both characters have a point and feel like they have a really strong argument.
The only thing I'll go back to, though, is that T'Pol does interpret Archer's orders that goes against her own personal opinion earlier on when she does take command. So you can kind of understand that she isn't doing it just to be antagonistic towards Trip, you know?
Yes.
It's kind of a tough go because I think ultimately T'Pol wants to accomplish this mission successfully. And so if they already have Klang, I don't know, she's kind of in a tough spot there.
But is the show presenting this character in a way where people would like the character when the episode's over?
No, because I had a very tough time with T'Pol, like, the first couple seasons. It took me a long time to come around on her. But once I did, like, I really do appreciate that character.
Oh, totally.
You know? So you are right, though. Like, you're kind of setting the character up for failure with regards to audiences embracing her from the outset.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So, Cam, I think this is a strong pilot. You know?
It is.
I already kind of outlined why, but what's your final thoughts here?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's such thing as a flawless pilot for Star Trek.
A floxless pilot?
A floxless. There's many of those.
Yeah, yeah.
But, like, for me, this is, you know, you look at the era of which it's being made, this feels like a really good, entertaining attempt to kind of refurbish the Star Trek brand for 2001. you know, to bring that sort of aesthetic that's really popular in movies and TV, and to make the show try to feel contemporary, like something that young people might think is cool, at least until they hear the theme song.
Yeah.
Like, it has an energy about it that probably did annoy long-term Star Trek fans. I would have to imagine a lot of them didn't really care for this pilot.
No,
am
but
I
you
right?
Know, every single iteration of Star Trek series, you have old school fans saying, this isn't real Star Trek.
Yes.
You know, and then guess what? Years go by, everyone comes around on it.
Yeah.
So that's why it just makes me shrug my shoulders at this point. Like, whatever.
But I think, you know, bringing in this different visual look, I think the uniforms are a really good idea because they also feel very different. I think the show does a really good job establishing itself as being a different type of Star Trek show in this pilot and introducing a mythology that feels like its own. It's, you know, I think a little bit maybe convoluted or a little bit confusing for a new viewer, but I think the show does a good job of setting up at least where the show from the pilot seems like it might be going.
All I can say is, for me, with almost 20 years of hindsight, I think it's much more of a success than I gave it credit for at the time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think this is a very, very strong series premiere. And we'll have fun maybe in the coming weeks or months about maybe ranking series premieres and talking about really what makes a strong series premiere. We've got many to dive into, and we've got many more ahead, so because CBS is giving everybody a spinoff at this point.
That's true. I do have a question for you, though. When we watch these pilots of all the Star Trek shows, like, we see the introduction of the captain, and the captain is the most important character in most cases on the show. How do you think they did it setting up Archer as the captain of the NX-01?
I don't think it's the strongest because he came off more as a jerk than anything else. And I go back to what I was saying about the racism and inclusivity and diversity question. I don't think this is the strongest window into him, especially as we get to know this guy more and more. He seems like a pretty chill guy, a pretty good guy. I mean, he has like a tougher time in, say, season 3, where his principles are really stretched, but I don't think that was the intention. I think they definitely mellowed him out in the ensuing 2 seasons, for sure.
Yeah, it's kind of tough because usually the captain gets kind of like a big inspirational moment. But in this pilot, that really comes from Zefram Cochrane, you know, the baton passing character who gives this great speech about going off, you know, into and reciting the Star Trek taglines basically in a speech. And it's like a great moment because you get that followed by the launch of the ship, which is like your big chill inducing moment. But you don't really get Archer giving like a big kind of speech about what their mission is going to be, like you do with like Janeway, for example, in Caretaker, where you're just like, I am on board with this character.
Don't worry, Cam. We get to wait until Shockwave with the Gazelle speech, and that's where it all comes together.
Okay. So I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Give this episode a sequel, Cam. You and I have talked about it. There's many an episode that really deserves a follow-up. We are going to be diving through all the series and just spelling out some of the strongest episodes that really deserved, you know, some more story following up later on in the series.
That's right. Okay, you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in Vulcan Compound Party, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in N-X-O-1.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.